Welcome back to Season 3. This season we'll be looking at a new aspect of sustainability, the healthcare sector. And so, our season title is A Manifesto for Surgical Health in Africa. I have invited Professor Bruce Bickard to host this season, the first time Earthcast will be hosted by someone other than myself. Bruce will unpack his new book through interviews with African and global experts in the field who helped him write it.
Evening, everyone. Welcome to the next episode of a series of podcasts. In the previous episodes, we've discussed the state of surgery and anesthesia in Africa and potential strategies on how we might improve health outcomes in Africa. But to effect these positive changes for surgery, we need to take these messages to a global audience. So part four of the book discusses advocacy for safer surgery and anesthesia for all. It addresses financing, health, and political leverage. The financial case for ensuring quality surgical care is actually surprisingly easy to make, especially as surgical care is needed in the treatment of nearly a third of all medical conditions. I would recommend that you read this. In this episode, we're going to discuss political leverage. How do we make governments accountable and what strategies to communicate surgical needs with politicians? My two guests today are activists in this space. I'd like to introduce Lydia Cairncross, who's Professor of Surgery and Head of Surgery at the University of Cape Town. She is an endocrine and oncology surgeon by background and brings her surgical work and leadership a strong equity and public health lens, seeing surgery as part of a continuity of care in the health system. She is also on the steering committee of the People's Health Movement of South Africa, a global network of health activists who campaign at grassroots and policy level for the right to health for all. Welcome, Lydia.
Thanks very much, Bruce.
And then I'd like to introduce Dr. Wayne Morris. He's a practicing anesthesiologist and associate professor in Christchurch, New Zealand. He's the current president of the World Federation of the Society of Anesthesiologists, and previously served as the chair of education and the director of programs. Dr. Morris has lectured in over 60 countries worldwide and published articles on a range of global anesthesia-related topics, including workforce, international standards, patient safety, pain management, and education. Welcome, Wayne.
Thanks, Bruce. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes, thanks for both of you for joining me this evening. I'm just going to start with a short reading from the book to set the scene. Citizens and civil society can effect enormous pressure for change in health. One need look no further than HIV and the role that men and women in the street played in transforming HIV care. The inability to access antiretrovirals led to funding through advocacy by the Treatment Action Campaign, or TAC. The strength of this movement was characterized by many small actions of many people. There are many stories. A colleague who was a provincial coordinator for the TAC spent his Saturdays educating through workshops to teach the public about HIV. There was a tremendous commitment to creating a public awareness about HIV, its treatment, and human rights. This educational foundation led to the success of the HIV movement. And I think it's only through education that citizens and civil society can rise and demand the social accountability necessary from governments to deliver safe surgery for all. And so I'm going to start with you, Lydia. I mean, you've been at the forefront of advocacy for health equity across many platforms, from grassroots to government. Can you tell us how you got involved in community health activism and what you've learned are factors to empower communities to demand access to quality health services?
So I became involved in health activism almost prior to becoming a doctor. So seeing the need for social justice across the board, both as a high school student, university student, and then as a doctor, and as a junior doctor, certainly in South Africa, and I'm sure everywhere in the world, the inequalities of our society are really stark, because everything washes up in the end at the doors of casualties and emergency departments. So whether it be around access to treatment for HIV or access to surgical care, it's been part of how I translated that sadness and anger really around lack of access for our communities into some kind of tangible action. So what that's looked like for me really has been a range of activities, including things like petition and protest and so on, but also very importantly, community-based bi-directional learning. So small in-person workshops with a really developing layer of health leadership that's emerging from the community bottom-up. These are women and men, mainly women and youth, who are looking at their communities and asking the questions about why their health outcomes are so poor, and partnering with us as academics and health professionals to try and unlock the infrastructure required to actually make a tangible shift in the balance of power to implement policies that will produce change.
Thanks, Lydia. It's interesting that you have got to the point that the community is inquiring about poor health outcomes. Was this your initial experience? Because I get the feeling there's a lack of awareness of how poor surgical outcomes are. And it's not because people don't care about how they deliver surgery. It's just the environment's created a situation where the quality of surgery isn't quite what it should be.
I think that communities are acutely aware of poor surgical outcomes, but unlike disease-specific campaigns, it's difficult to put this under a banner or under a headline. So unlike, you know, TB access or HIV or even single issues around cancer delivery, it's more difficult to mobilize communities around saying, actually, my access to diagnostic services and surgical care is inadequate because surgery spans a broad array of diseases. So people know that my aunt or uncle went to the hospital and came back and got a wound infection or died in ICU or didn't get into ICU, but they don't see that as there's something wrong with the surgical system, which is, of course, part of our educational imperative.
Thanks, Lydia. I think this concept of surgery being cross-cutting across disciplines is hugely important, and it is discussed at length in the book, and it is one of the barriers to communities and societies understanding the need for quality surgery, because it's hard to pigeonhole it or put it in a silo. I'm going to now just move to Wayne and shift the conversation to the other extreme about global resolutions, which should result in government policy. So Jeremy Schiffman provides a structure for communicating these priorities with politicians, and one is active power. And I think the active power we've had has provided a policy cohesion at a global level to provide safe surgery for all. And that really was the culmination in the WHA 68.15 resolution for safe surgery. And we have genuine champions for the cause of safe surgery through people like John Miro, who led the Lancet Commission for Global Surgery, and Emmanuel Makasa from Zambia, who led the first NSOAP. And we've had them as previous guests on this podcast. There are obviously other respected global voices in this space, and from the World Federation of the Societies of Anesthesiologists, there's yourself, Wayne, who is the president. And you presented for the WFSA at the most recent World Health Assembly to support the WHA Resolution 76.2. And the importance of that is it states that emergency, critical, and operative care are accepted as integral to a comprehensive primary healthcare approach. Now, this is a massive step forward at an international level, recognizing that universal healthcare is impossible without operative care. And my question to you is, what was your impression of the feeling within the WHA at the time of discussing this resolution? And do you think governments are honestly ready to embrace this resolution? And what was your impression subsequently in the response to governments to this resolution? The reason I'm asking this is because the uptake of the resolution 68.15 for safe surgery by governments has been disappointing in my view.
Thanks, Bruce. There's quite a lot of parts to that question, and it might be worth going back a step and just saying why we were there. So WFSA is a federation of national member societies, and we represent anesthesiologists in almost 150 countries worldwide. But what's important is that we have an official liaison role with WHO, and that means that we can speak at official WHO meetings. I think in general, any time that we speak at a WHO meeting, it's not only good for my specialty, but it's good for surgical care in general. And a really basic point is that surgical care is not often mentioned at that World Health Assembly level, at that WHO level. So any time that we can talk about it is really important, because we're helping to raise awareness and we're helping to reinforce this point that you can't have universal health coverage unless you have access to safe surgical care. And you can't have access to safe surgery unless you have access to safe anaesthesia. And it's this sort of basic messaging which is so important. And I think Resolution 76.2, it's integrated emergency, critical and operative care for universal health coverage and protection from health emergencies. This resolution really grew out of, I think, of an acknowledgement that there was a failure of systems during the pandemic and care was not integrated very well. And there are a lot of resources taken away from non-COVID care to treat patients with COVID. So this is an attempt to really integrate those parts of health systems, emergency, critical and operative care. And it's also really stating very strongly that they're necessary for universal health coverage. So it's good that this resolution was discussed. And I think the feeling was positive that it was something that needed to be done. And I think it's put surgical care back on the WHO agenda. The resolution was passed unanimously. I guess the challenge for all of us is that it's all very well to pass these resolutions, but it's what you do next that's important. And I don't know whether you want to ask anything more at this stage, Bruce, but I've got a few thoughts on that as well.
Thanks, Wayne. Certainly, because I think, you know, the next question that I wanted to ask both yourself and Lydia, so maybe it's appropriate for you to carry on and then move to Lydia. But from your, you know, your perspective and experiences, what strategies can we use to ensure governments change and respond to these resolutions, particularly in low resource environments such as Africa?
Just to give an example, one of the things that's been set up after passing Resolution 76.2 is the Acute Care Action Network. And this has been driven by a unit in WHO. And basically, it's a grouping of WHO, some governments, communities and other partners, organisations like WFSA. And it's supported by the Lauderdale Foundation and the American Heart Association. And the idea is that they're really going to help drive implementation of this resolution. There are other things that came out of Resolution 68.15, and that was the development of national surgical obstetric and anaesthesia plans. And that was largely driven by the program in global surgery and social change, so Harvard Medical School. And I think that has lost some momentum in recent years. We can blame the pandemic for a lot of things, but I think it is reasonable to blame the pandemic here. Just going back to your early question about disappointment about where 68.15, strengthening emergency and essential surgery and anaesthesia care, it has, I think, been disappointment, but we can say that, unfortunately, the pandemic has derailed progress on universal health coverage, and we really need to work hard to get it back on track. So all of these things, like ensuring that the Acute Care Action Network, also this attention put back on development of national surgical obstetric and anaesthesia plans, all of these are so important in converting what's on paper to making real progress in the field.
Thanks, Wayne. I'm going to move to Lydia now. I mean, Lydia, from your perspective, you know, how can we push governments to respond, particularly in our environment?
Getting the correct policy framework on the table is a critical first step, and I don't think we should underestimate the victories that have come over the last decade or so for surgical advocacy, that surgery is recognized as a critical part of any health response, critical part of universal health care. And the next step, of course, is to translate policy into action. And I think at a governmental level, where we have potential for leverage is that a lot of departments of health are starting to move away from a siloed and disease-specific linear approach to health care and health service delivery. And surgery comes in with the potential to say, actually, to improve surgical care, you have to improve the health system. You have to strengthen every component of it. You can't just come with one set of drugs and deliver it through to the lay population through a number of providers, for example. You need to have physios, OTs, anesthesia specialists, technicians in theater, equipment, OPDs that work, equipment in theater that's functional. And so while that's maybe perceived as a barrier to strengthening surgical care, it's actually an advocacy advantage. Because we're going in not saying we want to campaign for money for one particular cancer or for rheumatoid arthritis, but we want to campaign for something that actually strengthens the entire system and strengthens the health workforce across the board. Also, it strengthens the interconnection between primary, secondary, tertiary, and quaternary care, because we know that you can't deliver quality surgical care without a good, strong referral base, bringing patients in with the early diagnosis and also reintegrating into the community with rehabilitation specialists. So surgery goes from being the sort of high end, this is just for individuals, can't be afforded, it's sort of special care for the elite, to actually being something that embeds the health system in the community and strengthens the health system globally. And I think that's the angle that we need to bring in.
Thanks, Lydia. You've touched on quite a few things, which are also discussed in other parts of the book. So certainly in financing health, the importance of understanding how surgery is contributing to a whole lot of parts of health that have been siloed, and actually they can't exist without a functioning surgical service. And that's exactly what we saw during the pandemic, for example. That's the one part, and you've touched on what will be in the next podcast episode, which would be the final, looking at the sort of parts of the book, and it's about health system strengthening. And this fact that surgery, because it's cross-cutting, actually the whole system requires it, but there's a bigger part about strengthening the whole health system to allow a situation where these cross-cutting disciplines support it. I'm going to ask now, going to go one level up, so moving from looking within the health system and staying with governments is, you know, governments have got all these competing interests. And I suppose the one really important one is, like, how do we manage the need for health for all and creating a sustainable environment, because they're so closely interlinked. What's the strategy for advocating here with governments? I would like either of you to respond, or both of you.
So I think I'll comment on that, and also a little bit about building a leadership base within communities. So, of course, health competes. Within health, there's competition for resources, and also between health, education, water, sanitation, and so on. I think when we're talking about surgical systems and the health system, we need to spotlight the fact that so many surgical conditions affect the younger members of the population and affects directly the human workforce available for economic and population development. So one car accident with one femur fracture that's poorly treated can mean, you know, 30 years of work that's lost from a young woman or man that's subjected to that. And similarly with death from hemorrhage after cesarean section. So I think infectious disease is often seen as, if we treat that well, we're going to save a lot of lives. So I think advocating around the fact that early treatment and high quality treatment of surgical conditions timeously results in a healthier population, and to bring that into the conversation. So continuing to say 30% of all health conditions are surgically related. This is the population level impact that we have when we do this well, and the population level impact that we have when we don't do it well. And we know the trauma burden in South Africa, for example, is massive. And a lot of that relates to the quality of surgical care in terms of its impact on communities. So I would say that would be one angle in relation to that. But we should also know that our politics of today is driven very much by where the balance of power really sits. And I think the balance of power in relation to public and private healthcare, we need to surface some of that and some of the inequalities between an underfunded public system and, in many instances, an overserviced private health system. And our partners in that are, once again, coming back to community power and community advocacy. And we as surgeons can't go and look for a disease-specific patient support group on a particular illness to try and campaign and champion our cause. So we actually need to look at what are the community structures that are developing and growing that are holding accountable our health services at their most primary level, where the clinics sit within communities. And for our surgical advocacy, those are the structures that we need to go and support and work with and get advice from, actually, about how you shift power, as we saw happened so successfully around HIV and AIDS with the Treatment Action Campaign.
Thank you, Lydia. Wayne, would you like to add a perspective to Lydia's response?
Thanks, Bruce. I'd like to pick up on something that Lydia said earlier about the siloed thinking. And I know it's a theme in your book as well, and it really has been making our case much more difficult over the years. And as Lydia said, it is all about health systems strengthening now and really seeing surgical care as just an integral part of good health systems everywhere. And that's the sort of messaging which is, it's really simple messaging, but it's the sort of messaging that we need to keep on repeating to the decision makers, the funders and other people, because it's not particularly well understood. And I think there is often the idea that we are just doing our job in the operating theatre and it's not understood very well what's happening outside the operating theatre and our multiple roles in different parts of the hospital. So I guess one of the big things I've been struck with over the years at that high level is how simple our messaging has been, and it has to be. And I think I've got better at being more consistent with our messaging, and there's good consistency between the groups, the surgeons, the anesthesiologists and the obstetricians, for example. Another thing that's really important is that we need to be focusing on solutions. And again, this is pointed out in your book. It's important to tell people that 30% of the global burden of disease is surgical disease. It's important to point out the problems of workforce and other issues that we know are affecting delivery of surgical care to patients. But we need to be coming up with solutions, and workforce is a big one. And I don't think we as specialties have always been particularly good at identifying solutions, especially in that workforce space.
Wayne, that's actually a perfect place to wrap this podcast up. I could speak to two of you for ages, but unfortunately we don't have the time. I think one of the quotes in the book is this concept of you can't go to government with problems. What you really need to go is you need to go with three solutions. And I think, you know, there are different strategies for that, and there's different strategies for communicating with government, which has been very interesting, just to both your different experiences with this. But yes, that message is we have to go with solutions, otherwise we'll never be successful. Now, just before we close, I just need to ask you, is there a question I didn't ask that I should have asked and you would like to address?
One always feels like you should say something when someone asks you something like that, Bruce. And I suppose the thing to say is that when we're talking about advocacy around surgery, we have some disadvantages, you know, the cross-cutting, the general and so on, but we have some real advantages as well. Surgery and surgical care is really evocative. And we can showcase the curative impact of surgery on lives. And I think we mustn't hesitate from bringing that emotional element into our appeals and into the work that we do. The consequences of not doing it right or not having access at all. And the almost miraculous results that we can produce with surgical care. Sight to people who can't see, hearing to those that can't hear, life to those dying from cancer. You know, we must lean into that as well, as part of the work that we do, and as we put the statistics through and we talk about quality of life and productivity and those things, we must also bring the emotional human element into our argument, because that's fundamentally what it is all about.
Thank you, Lydia. Thank you, Wayne.
So one thing I didn't mention before, but it is covered in the book, is just the importance of measuring stuff. And another thing that could really help us with going to the next step after these resolutions is making sure that we have appropriate data collection. And there is a process that you're well aware of at the moment, an Ortstein process, which is defining surgical metrics. Our listeners probably know that originally the Lancet Commission suggested 6 surgical metrics, and this Ortstein process has now cut that down to 5. So surgical workforce density, geospatial access to care, surgical volumes, perioperative mortality, and catastrophic expenditure. It's easy to say we should collect these, but the next step is actually really defining those metrics and producing a how-to guide. And that's work that's going on at the moment. And I know that your centre, Bruce, and also Ghana are going to be piloting a project where we're looking at the feasibility of collecting this data. Another final point I'd like to make, and it sort of goes with health system strengthening, is that in healthcare for too long we've had this idea of zero-sum gain, that if infectious diseases get some funding, then it's taken from somewhere else. And I think that did happen during the pandemic. And I think consistent with what Lydia said, we really need to change that thinking to all boats rise with the tide. What we want are strong health systems everywhere. And you can't just pick and choose the components of the health system. You need to be thinking about everything that makes up good functioning quality health systems and ensuring that there is appropriate resourcing for each of those parts, including anaesthesia and surgical care.
Thanks very much, Wayne. We will need to stop at this point. So, lastly, I just want to thank the two of you for your contributions. You feature in the book, and I appreciate everything you've done for advocacy for surgery and just advocacy in general. The last podcast about the book, which follows this one, is basically about health system strengthening and a manifesto for safe surgery and anesthesia. It's really a challenge to the reader. So I hope you enjoy that one. And thanks for joining us tonight. Goodbye.